For the week of October 24th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 76, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And gloating over my new iPad in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And green with jealousy in New York, I'm Michael Gilts.
I've been using an iPad and I really like it. So how do you like it, Karen?
I love it. I don't know how I survived without it.
I know. It's one of those things that when you first hear about it and see it on television, you're like,
I mocked it.
Yeah.
Totally mocked it.
It's one of those things. And then you get it and you can't. It's like a fax machine. How could we ever have lived without cell phones and fax machines?
How do you use it?
Well, because I'm too lazy to actually, you know, get up off my couch when I have to, because I do social media for a living. I have to be checking my channels all the time, my Facebooks and Twitters. So it makes it so much easier for me to just not have to get off the couch. I just pick it up and check it. That's primarily how I use it. I also use it to read the news at night in bed, because God forbid I should have to actually sit at my desk to read the news.
Do you find surfing the web more fun, more natural that way? That's a lot of people say.
No, actually, I don't find it particularly natural. I'm getting used to that. But I have this really weird obsession with the screen keyboard because it makes these weird little taps. So it's like I'm living in, like, you know, Buck Rogers land or something. I'm like tapping things and you can hear it and you can see it. It's really kind of a weird, very satisfying feeling.
Okay, I'm
easily satisfied. Go ahead and make the joke.
Oh, I wasn't going to even go there, but because we have so much news to talk about, I was actually just listening and waiting for a moment to actually interject some informational items for our listeners. In fact, we have so much news to talk about today, we're going to have to talk twice as fast. We're going to have Jonathan Handel on from The Hollywood Reporter, and of course, he's a lawyer at Troy Gould. He's going to talk about what's going on with the Hobbit boycott down in New Zealand. And I suppose we could also talk about what Mel Gibson is up to or not up to, whatever the case may be. And then in television news, forget about it. We'll talk about a huge fight going on right now in New York between the Fox Network and Cablevision. It, of course, has to do with that sticky issue of retransmission rights. I can't even say it. Speaking of which, Google TV is going to have to start cozying up to some of the networks to get their own retransmission rights if they hope for Google TV to be a success. Of course, we'll review the week's top entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. And we'll end with a little inside baseball by talking to Adam MacArthur, the head of Rupert Murdoch's new venture Foxtix, a competitor to Ticketmaster, which launched in Australia last week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the weekend before Halloween, the number one film at the box office was Paranormal Activity 2, which scored an astonishing $41.5 million, blasting away everyone's predictions for what the movie would make. At number two is Jackass 3D, which I finally saw. It grossed $21.6 million. It's at $87 million total, so it's already the highest grossing Jackass movie of all time. At number three is Red, a slightly more adult-leaning action film with Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren, which grossed another $15 million and is holding well and grossed $43 million so far. It's probably the sleeper hit of the last few weeks. At number four, opening fairly weakly, is Clint Eastwood's film Hereafter, starring Matt Damon, about a sad psychic. That grossed $12 million. But remember, Clint Eastwood movies tend to hold very, very well. So we'll see how it does in weekend two before we jump to any judgments. And at number five is The Social Network, which continues to pull it in. $7.3 million, $73 million total. At number six is Secretariat, $6.9 million, getting good word of mouth. That's at $37 million total. At number seven is Life as We Know It, the Katherine Heigl film with Josh Duhamel as the newly minted star of Hollywood, according to Karen. That goes to another $6.1 million, so it's still a pretty modest $37 million total. And the rest were at $3 million or less. The Legend of the Guardians, the animated Owl movie, The Town, Ben Affleck's film, Easy A, the high school comedy, and Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, which managed to eke out another week almost in the top 10. It's at number 11. So that's what we saw. I saw Hereafter and Jackass 3D. Jackass 3D was exactly what I expected. And so was Hereafter, which was kind of sappy and sentimental and not very good. Did you guys see any movies this weekend, or were you just stuck at home with your iPad, Karen?
I was stuck at home with my iPad and my Netflix, though, because I can watch Netflix on my iPad.
Oh, that's right.
And how does it work? I mean, do you find that it works well on the iPad?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. It's convenient because I can watch TV in bed without having to actually open my laptop and move it to my bed and place it on a pillow. But you have to keep your knees up.
You know what?
That's sort of irritating.
I think we should probably change the subject. Because so far, all we've talked about is a lot of the stuff you're doing in bed, Karen. Have you noticed that?
I know. I watched The Joneses, which is that Demi Moore, David Duchovny movie.
I don't even know it. Yeah.
Yeah. I've kind of seen.
Yeah. It kind portions. Of came and went in theaters a few months ago. It's a cute movie. I mean, it's watchable. It's not good.
Well, of course, the big news box office wise over the weekend was Paranormal Activity 2. As you mentioned, Michael, it is the highest grossing opening weekend ever for a supernatural horror movie. I can't talk today for some reason.
Well, that's a really stupid.
I know. You know, that's why I brought it up.
That's a really stupid genre to make up. A supernatural horror movie. It doesn't mean it grossed more than, say, a Saw film or Friday the 13th. But if it's a horror film with a supernatural element, then it's, you know, they're getting too nitpicky.
I agree with you. Now, I would say the only legitimate record that it did break was the Thursday midnight screening box office record for a horror film.
Again, that's also parsing a little.
People are like making up things.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
They just make up genres. Sitting up, we're the number one film starring a girl from Australia. You know, whatever.
Wait a second. I'm just writing that genre down just in case I need to use it. Well, of course, Jackass fell off a truck. I mean, it dropped 57%.
No, 57%. I think it's fine. It grossed an unbelievable amount its opening weekend. So it grossed more its second weekend than it did in its first weekend, practically, in the first two times around. It's at $87 million.
It's the type of movie people see the first or second weekend. And after that, people are usually like, eh, we'll just Netflix it.
It's going to hit $100 million. And it's you know, if I could take the three movies and edit together the good parts, there'd be a good 45, 50 minutes there that's really kind of damn funny, I have to say. I can do without the gross stuff, though.
Well, it's made more money than any of its predecessors, Jackass 1 or 2. Again, that it's 3D, so 90% of the income coming from 3D business.
And they also say that they have enough footage left over for another movie very quickly. They were going to just expand the DVD, but now they're like, you know what? Maybe we should just release another film come January or February. So that's very likely to happen.
Speaking of doing things very quickly, Paranormal Activity 2, Jackass 3D, both Paramount films, but Paranormal Activity 2, it comes less than a year after, or about a year after the first film, which was kind of a $15,000 low budget indie film that Paramount picked up. And they're saying that it's going to do probably a little less than what the original did, which it made over $100 million, I think $121 million.
Did you guys see the original?
I did not.
I did.
So
I
thought it was scary.
Yeah, I was not scared. I'm easily scared. I was bored.
What? Yeah. It moved kind of slow. I can see that. I was not bored. I was scared to death. It wasn't as scary as The Ring, where I spent half the movie hiding behind my hands, but there were definitely some moments.
So will you go see this one?
I wanted to see it this weekend, but I couldn't find anybody who wanted to see it with me. And then I became obsessed with my iPad.
Yeah, well, I was going to say maybe because you were in bed all weekend, but overall...
I was in bed all weekend with my... I should name him, shouldn't I?
Oh, it's a him. Okay, that's interesting.
He spends a lot of time in bed with me. <Let's hope.
laughs> Well, Karen, even though you didn't go to the movies this past weekend, I guess a lot of people did because overall business was up nearly 12% from the same weekend last year, which is a statistic I know, Michael, you hate to quote. So we should probably move on to some of the other movie news of the week. And let's start maybe with Mel Gibson, who is... and then is not going to appear in the Hangover sequel.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. I mean, was it just his people that leaked it to make it look like he was still relevant and doing something cool? I mean, because if they did, they really sort of screwed up because it looked even worse when they changed their minds.
I wonder if it was Zach Galifianakis's people. Now, Zach Galifianakis is the comedian and the actor who starred in the first Hangover. He stars with Robert Downey Jr. in the upcoming Due Date, which Todd Phillips also directed, and he mentioned on a podcast that he was not very happy with the decision to cast Mel Gibson.
Not quite. He didn't specify what he was unhappy about. He said he was unhappy about a movie he was working on right then and said he wasn't that powerful, but he let his unhappiness known, but he couldn't say what the movie was or what he was unhappy about. But I think what happened is that I'm not sure whether the news of Mel Gibson's cameo got out first or the news of people being unhappy, because apparently the studio got complaints from studio executives, people working on the film, and obviously the actors, at least Zach Galifianakis. And so it filtered out that people were unhappy. And then, of course, they decided to dump him, which was a nightmare. And now they've cast Liam Neeson in the role. But The Hollywood Reporter had a story. The crazy thing I found in it was a quote from an unnamed studio source who's in his 20s, who says that people in his generation don't really care about what Gibson said. It's just a generational thing. And he said that to us, quote, he's just another wacky celebrity, end quote. I'm like, what? People under 30 don't care if you're a racist, homophobic son of a bitch? That doesn't matter to them anymore? You know, what a bizarre thing to say. So Mel Gibson has lost his talent agency, William Morris. You know, Warner Brothers was the studio behind The Hangover. So that's, you know, practically his home base as far as Hollywood's concerned. And now they've very publicly decided it wasn't worth the problem just to put him in a cameo in a movie playing a nutty guy. You know, he's playing a crazy guy in the movie, for heaven's sake. It's not like it's a romantic comedy. So
he has to do, though, is lay low for a while.
Yeah.
A long while. And then let The Beaver come out.
If they ever release it.
Well, yeah, that's true. Because The Beaver, if they wait too long, then the big story about The Beaver coming out will be that it was too, you know, took 2 years for it to come out, and this is why, and then it'll make it all.
You might want to explain what The Beaver is, and I'm almost afraid.
Curling, I know where you're going with this. Okay, so The Beaver is, it's kind of a strange or a wacky story about a guy who only speaks through a puppet, which is a beaver.
A hand puppet.
And that's actually all I know about it, but it was really popular when it was, you know, when it was first casting.
It was a famous script. Jodie Foster directed the movie. She brought Mel Gibson in to do it. And nobody's really seen it, but the studio suddenly panicked because they were just getting ready to release it or take it to a festival. And his latest incident of saying, you know, violent, homophobic, hateful things came out. This one related to his girlfriend and tapes that she leaked, which may or may not have been edited. But anyway, it's, you know, he became a PR nightmare, and they've held the film and they have no plans yet to release it. I'm sure they will, but maybe it'll be fall of 2011.
Well, we probably should have started off talking about Paramount. Of course, Paramount has the number one and number two movies at the box office this week, Paranormal Activity 2 and Jackass 3D, except they also lost two movies this week, two big movies.
That's right. They lost. Disney purchased the right to Marvel. They bought the Marvel company. And of course, there are a lot of Marvel products that are out in the universe, including The Avengers and Iron Man 3. And those were with Paramount. But Paramount just sold the distribution rights to those movies to Disney for $115 million minimum. They may get more depending on how the movies do. And quote, they don't have to do any work, end quote, which was what one of the studio execs boasted. Which makes them sound like they're kind of some bums or something who just want to sit around and collect a paycheck. I'm not quite sure why Paramount sold it. I'm not quite sure if the deal is good enough for them to make as much money as they would have otherwise, because, you know, they'd make more than $60 million off each of those movies. So it just seems like a strange decision to me.
Is it just me, or does Paramount seem to be sort of falling apart?
Well, they've got the number one and number two movie at the box office, but they're sort of
quicking. I have a feeling that's kind of just a coincidence.
Yeah.
Well, in what way are they falling apart?
Well, they've had a lot of regime changes over the past, what, 2-3 years?
You mean as the head of the studio, Adam Goodman now?
Yeah, and it was, like, what, John Lesher for, like, a minute, and it feels to me like there's something off over there, and I have no inside scoop here. I'm just – something feels like it's going wrong over there.
Well, I believe they have a couple of good movies coming out, one of which is The Fighter, so –
Well, like Case 39. Let's look at Case 39. That's a Paramount movie, isn't it? This is the one with Bradley Cooper and Renee Zellweger, what happened to her career, that sat on a shelf for like 2 years because it just kind of had to like languish through Paramount regime changes. And then finally they just dump it. I mean, it seems like people aren't talking to one another. It seems as if like one guy leaves and one guy, let's emphasize that, one guy leaves and like doesn't tell anything to the next guy about like what's going on. The next guy has to like figure out what their movies are. I mean, it feels like something is wrong.
Well, something is certainly wrong if you're giving up Iron Man and the Avengers, but there is probably something going on in the background there that we are not aware of. I'm not sure what the rights were for it and how Disney wound up getting it back, but for them, it's going to be $115 million. Is a small price to pay for what could be a $1 billion franchise, especially when you start thinking about theme parks.
Right, and people have talked about Disney's is moving aggressively to work the Marvel characters into their theme parks, which will help them tremendously because they're great with little girls, but they need more properties for young and teenage boys, and Marvel will make them cooler very, very quickly.
Yes. Of course, the biggest news, and we probably should have started with this, the biggest news of the week, in my opinion, besides the whole Mel Gibson brouhaha, was The Hobbit, which is now, as we reported last week, going to be directed by Peter Jackson. He made his name a household name by directing Lord of the Rings, and now he's going to direct the prequel, The Hobbit, in a two-part $400 to $500 million extravaganza. He's from New Zealand, but it turns out the film may not be shot in New Zealand the way Lord of the Rings was. And joining us to discuss this is Jonathan Handel, who has been a guest of the program before. Now, Jonathan, you are writing for The Hollywood Reporter now, and you are a lawyer for Troy Gould, a law firm here in Los Angeles. But the Hollywood Reporter gig is kind of new.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's exciting to be with The Reporter, especially since there's going to be a relaunch and a glossy magazine and so forth coming up. But yeah, I've been covering the Hobbit situation extensively for The Reporter.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there, how it started, where it is now? There's been 1,500 people were protesting in the streets of Wellington last week, and apparently there's going to be a protest this week as well.
Well, that's right. Actually, the rally this week happened yesterday. There were rallies this time in Wellington, Auckland, Christchurch, and three other locations connected with the filming of Lord of the Rings. So the country is really in an uproar. A number of government ministers, including the prime minister, have been on television, really saturation coverage down there, and are now meeting with Warner Brothers executives who have flown in. The situation is this. The local union, New Zealand Actors Equity, was trying to get Peter Jackson's company to bargain with it on conditions for actors. That wasn't happening, and finally the union asked the International Federation of Actors Unions for help on that, and they put a do-not-work order, a worldwide do-not-work order, on the picture. SAG and AFTRA were part of that order. British Equity, and so on and so forth, really across the English-speaking world. Well, that turned things into a very public spat, and Warners began to the process of threatening to move the production. What's happened now, and by the way, I should say that the threat of losing the production actually, according to currency analysts, helped drive the New Zealand dollar down.
Wow.
So it's kind of astonishing. But this is a $500 million two-film production and a small country. So what's happened now is that the labor unions ultimately blink a bit. They've taken off the do-not-work order. But Warners says that the damage may be done, and they're down there meeting with the government.
Now, didn't SAG and AFTRA almost immediately said, initially they said, no, we're going to back this boycott. But then they kind of backed off a little bit. They said, well, maybe not.
SAG and AFTRA kept the do-not-work orders in place until the middle of the week, last week, when they were requested by the New Zealand Equity to remove them at the same time that New Zealand Equity removed the...
Okay, so maybe that's what I'm thinking of then.
Did New Zealand Equity get anything in exchange for dropping that boycott?
Well, there's dispute over that. The contracts that are being offered to actors now actually have residuals in them for the first time in New Zealand, and did not previously have residuals. However, the observers on the other side of the table have claimed that, in fact, there was a residual concept set up beforehand. So like everything in this controversy, there are multiple points of view as to the facts, as well as opinions as to what should be done.
Now, the way I understand it now is that the local union has called off their boycott. They don't have any objections to the movie going forward. But Peter Jackson now says, well, yes, but they could change their mind in 6 months or a year. So we can't live with that threat. We're going to have to move it elsewhere. This is what Warner Brothers is going to do, because these people could change their mind a year down the road while we're in the midst of shooting part two and put us over a barrel even worse. But that seems like the same threat that every movie ever made has had to face.
Well, of course, movies in the U.S. don't face that because that kind of a threat, because collective bargaining agreements in entertainment have a 3-year term. So as long as an agreement is in place, Writers Guild agreement or whatever, Screen Actors Guild agreement, there won't be any strikes unless and until the renewal for the agreement falls apart, which is what happened with the Writers Guild that led to a strike, and also what happened with SAG. But in this situation, first of all, I should say it's Peter Jackson has not publicly said that he'll move the production. In fact, he's publicly said he doesn't want the production moved at all, and that he's angry and upset. It's Warner Brothers that's been public about this. What's interesting here is that Warners is saying, yeah, there's some continuing threat here, although the union has actually agreed explicitly that they won't take action against the production. But what Warners is doing now is meeting with the government, and there's a 15% not even tax credit, but 15% grant program, meaning that somewhere on the order of $75 million, 15% of $500 million, will be paid by the government of the production costs. The question is Warner Brothers going to extract even greater concessions from the government than that standard 15% program they already have in place there?
And Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens insist absolutely not. They've never said a word about this. They have no, they're not using this as a negotiating tactic. Not one word has come from them about this. They insist this to high heaven over and over again.
Philippa Boyens being the producer. Jonathan, you've mentioned that the country's prime minister, John Key, warned last week, or he said, you know, if you can't make The Hobbit here in New Zealand, frankly, what movies are you going to make here? Jackson himself said to New Zealand TV, and this is a quote, "One month ago, no one in a million years thought this movie was going to leave New Zealand. At that point, the confidence in our country as a stable base to make movies was eroded. Is the movie going to come or go? We don't know. Warners are coming here next Monday, and we've got to fight like hell." But he basically says, he said in a press release that it's moving.
No, he said Warners is coming to consider moving it, and he didn't, which is slightly different. And Warners, by the way, has been silent about this. So do the math, as it were.
Well, he says next week Warners are coming down to New Zealand to make arrangements to move the production offshore.
To make arrangements, yes, to begin arrangements. But here's the thing, in any case, the statement notwithstanding, Jackson certainly doesn't want that to happen. As he says, they'll fight like hell. So again, do the math. If you're Warners and you have a meeting with the economic development minister, attorney general, who's also the arts minister, and the prime minister, if they say, "We assure you that this is going to be okay," is Warners going to say okay and be done with it? Or is Warners going to say, "You know, we've suffered economic damage here and we need something to help deal with the uncertainty." And this government is going to look at the number of people who have protested in the streets, and there certainly is the strong possibility that the New Zealand government will cave and will offer greater concessions.
Well, Peter Jackson so did not want to shoot The Hobbit anywhere other than New Zealand, where he shot the Lord of the Rings trilogy, that he started building sets in New Zealand, kind of unilaterally making that decision, according to several sources. They've spent $30 million already building sets, and all of those sets are now in New Zealand.
But I don't understand that particular description of events, because that's where they expected to make the movie anyway. I don't think it was a unilateral decision. It was where he's based and where they're going to shoot the movie. So why wouldn't they build the sets there? It takes a lot of pre-production time. My question is, what benefit would Warner Brothers have by moving the film? They want to be in New Zealand because it's non-union and it's cheaper to shoot there. And obviously, Jackson's special effects production company is based there. If they moved it to England, which to me seems absurd, they would have the cost of moving the sets and they'd be in a union town anyway.
That's exactly right. And by the way, to fill in a detail on the building of the sets and unilateral versus not, when Jackson started building, and I haven't heard the $30 million figure. It's interesting, but you know, presumably there certainly is a significant expense. But when Jackson started building those sets, the picture had not yet been greenlit. The picture was only greenlit a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago or so. This is a movie that has had enormous problems with losing a director and lawsuits and MGM's bankruptcy. They're co-financing with Warners. To answer your question, why would Warners want to go to the UK? I think you're right that it would be a disadvantage for them to go to the UK, but it would also be a huge disadvantage to the New Zealand government and economy for the picture to leave. And so this may be sort of a bank shot, as it were, where the studio will use the labor prior labor dispute as a way of shooting for greater incentives. It's a game of chicken at this point.
Well, certainly we appreciate you coming on and filling us all in on what's going on down there. We'll keep our eye on it. And again, you're with The Hollywood Reporter now. You've always been with Troy Gould, but now you have a book coming out, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's right. And thanks for mentioning it. Hollywood on Strike should be out next month, and it's a recounting of the Writers Guild strike and the SAG stalemate, 2007 to 2009.
Well, when the release date arrives, you'll have to come back and talk about the launch of the book.
I'd be pleased to do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
Well, that was nice of him to take the time to talk to us. It's, you know, I am half Hobbit myself, so I'm very excited to see that this movie happens. And I, you know, it's bad enough we lost Guillermo del Toro. If we lose New Zealand as well, I think that's two bad things to happen to the movie in a row. That's too many.
You know, I think they have a pill that you can take now for that Hobbit condition, by the way. But now we probably should have kept Jonathan on to talk about some of our TV news. And we're kind of merging TV and digital media news this week because our big story, the world's big story, at least in the U.S., is News Corp versus Cablevision. And this is a retransmission contract agreement fight.
Right. And what makes this fascinating is how it's playing out in the new media. I was sitting in Yankee Stadium and a couple of my friends are Cablevision customers. They're in the borough of Brooklyn or far Brooklyn or some parts of Queens, and they subscribe to Cablevision. And so they weren't going to be able to watch the World Series on the Fox network, and they were freaking out. Didn't matter because
I can't even believe this. It's like holding people hostage.
We should say what this is all about. Fox, the local affiliate in New York, Fox 5, I believe, the Fox network has contracts with all of the multi-channel service providers. So Time Warner, Comcast, and in New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey, 3 million subscribers were affected when Fox pulled its channel, the local channel, off of television right in the middle of a Giants game.
And really?
I don't know if it was in the middle of a Giants game. But
No, I don't think so.
But they, you know, they missed two weekends of football so far, and all of the Yankees-Texas Rangers games, the American League Championship Series, and basically an entire week's worth of television. And there's been a lot of going back and forth in the media and with ads, Fox taking out ads against Cablevision and Cablevision taking out ads saying it's all Fox's fault. But in the end, it's the television viewers, the customers, that wind up being hurt the most.
As the FCC points out, which I think this is the first time anything like this has ever happened.
Right. Well, and
the FCC steps in and is like, hey, you guys, grow up, play nice.
And an FCC spokesman said the agency is, quote, closely monitoring the situation, and we are continuing to urge the parties to reach a quick resolution for consumers. But they're not reaching a quick resolution, and what do you mean you're just monitoring it? Granted, they don't have a lot of power in this particular instance, but you'd think that they would want to flex their muscle a little.
Well, didn't I hear on Buzz Out Loud that the FCC was actually streaming the game somewhere?
They were Twittering. They were Twittering the updates on the scores of the San Francisco Giants Philadelphia Phillies game, which is hilarious that they would do that. I found that fascinating. The other digital twist to this was that Fox was not simply off of Cablevision, but they were also blocking Cablevision subscribers who use internet via Cablevision from watching Fox programming on Hulu. That means they said, yeah, you think you can keep watching your Fox shows, but not if you're a Cablevision subscriber and that's where you get your internet from. So if you were a Cablevision subscriber, they would block your address from being able to access Fox programming on Hulu or anywhere on the net, I assume.
But if you had Google TV, you were set.
Well,
no,
yeah.
Yes. Well, perhaps, yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that.
Fox is one of the only networks that's participating in Google TV.
And to explain what all this is about in one sentence, it's that simply cable companies like Cablevision and Time Warner and DirecTV, they pay cable channels like MTV, Sci-Fi, every cable channel you can think, ESPN, they pay them money for every subscriber. They say, all right, we'll give you X amount of dollars every month because, you know, you're popular and brings us viewers. That doesn't happen for the major networks, so that didn't happen for a long time. And now the major networks are stomping their feet and saying, hey, we're more valuable than almost any other channel. Why aren't we getting more money than any other channel? And they're starting to demand a real fee because they want that second revenue stream, advertising plus retransmission fees. And so suddenly now cable providers are freaking out and they don't want to pay them the money they deserve or think they deserve. And it's creating this constant battle, which is not going to go away. But the idea of Twitter and blocking you if you're an internet subscriber via Cablevision from using Hulu, unbelievable.
Well, that's just flipping the bird at net neutrality, and Fox very quickly reversed that decision because they realized that a kind of a collateral damage to that would be anybody that used, say, DirecTV, but used Cablevision as their broadband provider to access the internet. So,
which would be almost no one.
Well, who knows? I mean, but still, it affected people who were not Cablevision subscribers for cable television. You know, net neutrality is meant to take care of that. And, you know, I think Richard Greenfield put it best. He has this blog. He's, of course, with BTIG Research, and he wrote a broadcast TV manifesto. He really felt that He's finding it harder and harder to comprehend how broadcast television stations can demand retransmission consent fees from multi-channel video providers like Cablevision, but at the same time place their content online for free via Hulu or CBS.com or TV.com, wherever. And he acknowledges that the greatest value of retransmission fees is access to sports programming, like the NFL, like Major League Baseball, and other live events like American Idol or the Oscars, none of which are streamed online for free. But how can broadcast TV stations, and in turn broadcast networks, maximize value when so much of their content is just being given away for free in other forms?
So he's saying stop Hulu.
His solution is that over the coming year, he expects to see the vast majority of free online streaming broadcast TV content delayed weeks, if not months, with the only immediate access to that content being via authentication. So that's that TV Everywhere model where if you are a subscriber to HBO, you can get HBO on your computer. If you are a subscriber to Cablevision, you can get all the Cablevision channels on your computer. So you have to still subscribe. So you can't cut the cord. And consumers, he says, consumers must be made to realize that nothing is free, at least legally.
Well, it's a perfectly reasonable business model. You know,
I was just going to say, I think he makes a point. I think that we're at that stage where nobody quite knows what the future business model is going to be. And so at this point, this works for them.
Right. Because I expect, you know, if I have, you know, Time Warner Cable, which I do, I have to buy a separate device called a Slingbox in order to access my programming from other sites. I shouldn't have to do that. They should provide that service. And it's a reasonable thing to expect.
They have... Yeah, that's true. You do need a box, but they have TV Everywhere, or whatever Time Warner's is called.
Right. They're starting to provide these services for everyone, and it's perfectly reasonable. Why shouldn't you? But then again, if you're going to pay for that, why are you giving it away to other people for free?
Well, now, Cablevision subscribers still could have gotten Fox by using over-the-air transmissions, which, by the way, are of higher quality than through cable, but we won't go into that.
Not high def.
Yes, high def transmits, I believe, at between 6 and 19 megabits per second, whereas on cable, it is 4 megabits per second. But again, that gets a little technical. Now, Michael, you just mentioned Slingbox, which is a way to control your TV and watch your DVR on your computer remotely. That is considered an over-the-top solution. Another over-the-top solution launched last week, Google TV. Karen, you brought it up. Three major networks have blocked Hulu and their websites from Google TV. Fox is available, but hasn't made a final decision yet as to whether they're going to remain accessible to Google TV. What do you guys think of this, Karen?
Well, I think that you would be sort of stupid to not go along with what Google's got planned, because Google has proven for the most part that they get it. And they tend to be sort of a step ahead in terms of a lot of this kind of stuff. I think I would probably have done what Fox did, and maybe the CW did too, trying it for like a finite period just to see.
Well, Google throws a lot of things against the wall and a lot of them don't stick, and that's okay. So I don't know that they're necessarily so incredibly savvy that they've got this thing figured out, because...
Well, they've screwed up in social networking, but they seem to be doing pretty well in terms of plugging into the zeitgeist and what people want in terms of search.
Gmail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, search is their thing, obviously. But yeah, this is a way of search. So it isn't, but they're just afraid of letting Google have charge of the whole portal to all of television.
And they're totally right to worry about that, because they would essentially be doing that.
Yeah, remember when that happened in music? Steve Jobs, anyone?
Yeah, but like, you don't want to let what happened to the music industry happen to you if you work in the TV business. It's your job to figure out what the next step is going to be. And I think that part of that is to give these things a test. Instead of just saying no, that they should say, well, maybe let's see.
You know, you're right. That's a good point, because the problem was not the fact that they cooperated with iTunes. The fact was that they weren't trying to do it themselves or letting anyone else do it. Like, finally, Amazon is a real competitor to iTunes. So the problem was not that iTunes was happening, that they were working with them. It's that they didn't have other things going on too. So that it wasn't just a monopoly.
Exactly. And the future of TV is online, and everyone's going to have to figure it out.
And you know what TV I've been looking at online? It's not really the show. It's more the photos from the show, and that's Glee.
Yes.
Oh, Glee.
Yes, that was the big television – well, not big television news. It was a big story that GQ is publishing these photos of cast members from Glee, and I have to say it's the best I've ever seen Lea Michele look. And I mean –
okay. I look at these pictures, and I think that Diana – is it Agron?
Diana Agron, yeah.
Hers are like, okay, you can kind of tell she's having fun with it. But like Lea Michele, it's like, my God, put some clothes on. I was disgusted.
She's really? Because I thought they were tongue in cheek. There's a the main shot I thought of her at the locker sucking on a lollipop. I thought was sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
That was, sort but what of about spoof. The one where she's like straddling the bench?
That's the other one. Yeah.
Diana Agron seems to be seeing it as tongue in cheek. I think Corey Monteith is almost irrelevant in these pictures. But to me, Lea Michele seems to really be taking it seriously. Like, okay, well, I'm pretending that I'm looking at this tongue in cheek, but I really think I'm pretty sexy. That was what I took away from that.
Well, she is pretty sexy in some of those photos. I mean, I've never found her.
Not denying that, but
I don't think she's attractive. I've never found her attractive at all. Don't think she's sexy. But you see those photos, and I'll tell you, you kind of go, "Who is that?"
And what's the controversy?
And that's why she did it, and that's why she seems desperate.
Well, and the controversy really is generated by the Parents Television Council. And Michael, I know you're a big fan of the Parents Television Council.
Well, I think you should always look at any advocacy group and see what is their actual, you know, are they just a guy in a room putting out a press release like Donahue, this guy in New York who pretends to speak for right-wing Catholics, and it's basically him talking, and yet he gets on all the national channels? Or do you actually have a broad-based group that supports what you're doing? The Parents Television Council is this group that sort of puts out press releases and annoyances about programming in TV and on radio and the movies. And they don't really have much of a following whatsoever. They claim 1.3 million followers, but the truth, according to one of their top people who left, is that at most 12,000 people a year donate money to the Parents Television Council. So you're looking at a very small group of people who get an outsized voice in what goes on in television. I mean, they've taken cases to the Supreme Court. They've got the FCC to put out things and put the fear of God into networks over, letting a curse word slip.
They're a pain in the ass, aren't they?
Yeah, they're really a pain in the ass, and they should not be given. They should not be feared. And networks are finally realizing, look, they don't represent a lot of people, and there's no reason to give them any more weight than they deserve.
And plus, they're failing at their job. On CBS, you have a show called Bleep My Dad Says, and you're supposed to fill in the bleep. And then you have CeeLo, one half of Gnarls Barkley, who has a solo album out, and a hit song from that album.
Which is really funny.
Yeah, which is really funny. The title of that song is, it contains the F word. Let's just say that.
But the Parents Television Council is not failing at their job unless they think their job is to make everything that ever appears anywhere on any media channel anywhere suitable for them and what they think is right. I mean, just want to sort of bring attention to things they find objectionable, great, they're doing their job. If they think none of these things should ever occur, then they're not succeeding at their job and they never should. And the New York Times has a good story about them and how they're sort of fading in popularity, how they're having financial troubles, how they've been dropping the ball. You know, they tell people to send in, complaint letters and we'll forward them to the networks, and they weren't even bothering to do that. They were just taking any money donations and throwing the letters in the trash. I mean, this is not an organization that deserves any influence or power.
Well, they said about these Glee photos that they were sexualizing actresses who play high school students. It borders on pedophilia. And GQ replied, "The Parents Television Council must not be watching much TV these days and should learn to divide reality from fantasy. As often happens in Hollywood, these kids, quote unquote, are in their 20s. Corey Monteith is almost 30. I think they're old enough to do what they want." And that's exactly what Diana Agron, the person, the actress in the photo, said.
Well, yeah, she had a little piece, that she said, all right, fine, if you're offended, I'm sorry. But they, and her photos were nothing.
They were nothing in comparison.
And she says, but, quote, "And if your 8-year-old has a copy of our GQ cover in hand, again, I am sorry, but I would have to ask, how on earth did it get there?" this is a gentleman's magazine. It's not intended for little children. Two more things. One is, where the heck are Corey's naughty nude shots? He's clothed entirely the whole time.
Bothers me too. That really bothers me.
But of course, the magazine is GQ. They want to look at the chicks. Though actually, GQ was basically a homoerotic magazine for a lot of men growing up in the 80s and 70s.
Exactly.
So, but that's
and let's be real. A photo shoot like that could be an Entertainment Weekly and it would be the exact same.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I don't know why the PTC got upset about this. 2 weeks ago, they had an episode with two girls kissing, a lesbian kiss, and a reference to scissoring. The one girl said, well, this is nicer than scissoring, having kissing each other. And I was like, which is a rather bawdy comment. It came in the first few minutes of the show. And I actually did think, you know what? That's that's a little too much. That's not right. This is a pretty family-oriented show, and it's great that they push the envelope on things that they embrace and talk about, but that was just sort of gratuitous and cheap and sexual, and I didn't really like it. And if they had said, you know what, that scissoring reference was a little crass and out of place for a show that reaches a lot of kids in middle school and high school, I would have said, you know what, I agree with you.
You know what? It's a fine line between what is seen as a big deal on television and what is seen as a, you know, just run-of-the-mill, big whoop stuff.
Segway alert!
Yeah, but that one was actually pretty, you know.
Yeah, that was nice.
A little, yeah. Well, yeah. That is a segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week. I've just said week twice. And we decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week, actor Martin Freeman. He better be prepared to attend comic book and sci-fi fantasy conventions for the rest of his life. The actor who starred in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, not to mention the UK version of The Office, cult classic Hot Fuzz, and the current BBC update of Sherlock Holmes, in which he plays Dr. Watson, he has just been cast as Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit, which will be filming in New Zealand and or other countries on the planet Earth. Let the furry feet jokes begin. Yes, it's man gets job story, but
I don't care. I love him. He's Tim from The Office.
Come on, Karen.
Oh, yay.
It's The Hobbit and the role of a lifetime. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is Tim from The Office. I mean, anything he does is a big deal.
That's awesome. I agree. I'm thrilled. I think, you know, when they announced who was playing Frodo, Elijah Wood, the second you saw him, you thought, wow, that's great casting. And I feel the same way with Martin Freeman. He's perfect for the role.
NPR fired news analyst Juan Williams after he appeared on the Bill O'Reilly Show for comments in which Williams admitted that when he sees people dressed in Arabic garb, his words, not ours, on a plane, he feels momentary unease. Williams said he was just being human and candid. NPR said that for years, the dual role of objective news analyst on NPR and opinion giver on Fox News, on which Williams has blasted Michelle Obama as a Stokely Carmichael in a dress who blames America first, simply didn't work, violated its ethics standards, and he had to go. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because of the way NPR handled it. They should have given him the choice. Do you want to be an opinion talking head or do you want to be an objective journalist? You got to choose.
Yeah, same thing. It's a big deal because of the way they mishandled it. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It, you know, was hardly a story until they made it a story.
Yeah.
Our next story is about Lindsay Lohan, unfortunately. She is back in court, and she's back in rehab. The court ordered her back there. A Beverly Hills judge ruled that Lohan violated probation yet again and sentenced her to drug rehab at the Betty Ford Clinic until January 3rd and random testing after that until her next court date on February 25th. And the judge really means it this time. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
The biggest deal here is that I live near the Beverly Hills courthouse and I could hear helicopters for like an entire hour. I thought that there was like a high-speed chase going on. I was so disappointed to see it was just her. Who cares? Big whoop.
Wait a second. Just an hour? Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay, well, then we'll just move right on. I mean, who knew they workshopped movies? That's standard procedure for Broadway plays and musicals people want to get a feel for. It's far less common in movies, but that's exactly what director Baz Luhrmann did with his adaptation of The Great Gatsby. He arranged a reading with Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby, Tobey Maguire as Nick Carraway, and Rebecca Hall of The Town as Daisy. No word yet on whether this will be his next movie. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal as far as an interesting way on approaching a film script and seeing how it plays out. Plus, there's an adaptation of Gatsby at the Public Theater right now. That's every word of the play, every word of the book done on stage. It's a 6-hour marathon. So the timing is right.
Well, I love the Great Gatsby book. I'm just crossing that one. 6 hours. It's definitely off my list. Karen?
You know, a friend of mine was just asking me the other day, whatever happened to Baz Luhrmann? And now I'm happy to report that he's doing something. I guess it's a big deal because they're doing it this way, but ultimately it's sort of a big whoop.
Well, I have a feeling I know your answer on this next story. Pixar has a long history of removing directors off of movies or adding on a second director to provide oversight. So while it's not surprising the director of the upcoming Pixar film Brave has been removed, it made more waves than usual because that director was a woman. And if there are very few female directors in general, there are almost none at all in animation. Brenda Chapman has been replaced by Mark Andrews, a longtime storyboard artist for Pixar, and director of several shorts. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
It's a big deal. It's a disappointment. There's nothing to suggest it's anything other than a creative decision. And it's a bummer. She co-directed The Prince of Egypt, and hopefully she'll get another shot down the road.
I'm pretty sure she will. Is Netflix the new Blockbuster? Blockbuster always refused to carry unrated movies, and sometimes movies that created controversy, much to the consternation of filmmakers since they dominated the movie rental business. Now Netflix is joining the game. It has decided not to carry Harmony Korine's new movie, Trash Humpers, which is about senior citizens who run around committing acts of vandalism and, apparently, getting off on humping bags of trash. Variety called it riveting beyond all rationality. But Netflix says, not for us. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm going to say they obviously have to choose at some point not to carry every movie in existence, though you think their druthers would be to carry at least one DVD of everything. I'm going to say it's a big deal. Why not have one DVD of it, for God's sake? It's a director that they've got all his other movies in. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Karen?
I agree for the same reason. But, I mean, Harmony Korine's kind of a hack. I mean, I'm sure it's not very good.
Yeah, that's why I hesitated.
Our next story is about Chris Rock, who is headed to Broadway. The actor and stand-up comic is headed to Broadway in a comedy drama by Stephen Adley Gurgis. I can't pronounce that name. That Sperling won't say on the air. You know, I'm not going to say this one on the air.
Can I say it? If you don't want to hear the title of the play, which contains an expletive, please skip over the next 5 seconds. The name of the play is The Motherfucker with a Hat.
Or The Hat, as many people are calling it. It's about a guy out of jail and fighting his addictions in love with a girl who is not fighting her addictions, not even close. Other stars of the show include Bobby Cannavale, Elizabeth Rodriguez, the lovely Annabella Sciorra. I can't pronounce any of these names for some reason. And then the play opens in April. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Man gets job.
It's a big deal because it's, you know, him on Broadway. It's a big deal for Broadway, that's for sure.
It's a big deal because you like to say the motherfucker with the hat.
Unbelievable. Well, here's another theater story. The animated film Madagascar has spun off two feature film sequels, the second coming out in 2012, a TV series, a TV Christmas special, and loads of merchandise. You can add a live stage show now to that mix. DreamWorks is launching a 90-minute theatrical called Madagascar, or Madagascar Live. It launches in January and will play 70 cities, including Radio City Music Hall. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal as other studios move into theatrical and realize that their properties can be leveraged in this way, just like Disney did, but it's also a good reason not to have kids.
Oh, amen to that.
Okay, then. The Sony Walkman is dead. The portable cassette stereo device, which debuted in Japan on July 1st, 1979, has now officially stopped being manufactured on October 22nd, 2010. Overall, the Walkman in its various iterations sold more than 200 million players. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And by the way, what the heck is a cassette?
Sad. It's sad, but it's a big whoop.
Michael?
Well, it sputters to an end, but I say it's a big deal. The Sony Walkman changed the music industry radically.
I think the Walkman passed away quietly in its sleep.
That's the way I see it.
Well, then here's a story you might care about. The iPad is outselling the Kindle. That's the expert opinion of Publishers Weekly, which is needed since Amazon refuses to release sales figures for the Kindle. The iPad has sold 7.5 million copies to date, and they haven't even had their first holiday season. Obviously, the iPad does much more and costs much more, as Karen now knows, than the Kindle. But it's not great news for Amazon anyway. Any way you slice it, Crunch Gear also claimed the Nook was outselling the Kindle earlier this year. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Did I tell you that I can get Kindle on my iPad?
Yes. And which is why, by the way, I think Amazon wins either way.
I agree. It's a big deal as far as the spread of ebooks, not necessarily at the expense of Kindle, as long as they keep selling well as well, and they have the best store right now.
U2, the biggest band in the world, is back in the studio working on two albums. The first is due out early next year and will be produced by Danger Mouse, a.k.a. Brian Burton. The second will be made with an eye on the dance floor and feature collaborations with Will.i.am, your favorite artist there, Michael, and Red One and the like. There's also a third album, but Bono and The Edge can't quite convince the other two guys, you know, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen Jr., that they should record an entire album of the songs written for Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to reserve judgment. I don't know.
Come on, Karen. It's Big Whoop. Guys, musicians in studio.
Okay, that's what I thought. But I'm like, maybe I missed something here. I don't really know my music news very well. Yeah,
guys
okay,
in studio.
Yeah, Big Whoop. Musicians in studio.
And Sperling needs to practice how to say that show title. Come on, Sperling, try it again.
Spider-Man, Turn of the Dark.
Much better.
I just let that. I winged that one.
Oh, it's awesome.
Well, of course, trying to get tickets to a U2 concert is quite difficult. I have not been able to get tickets to their U2 360 tour. And that actually brings us to our Inside Baseball segment of the week, where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And joining us this week is Adam MacArthur, the general manager of Foxtix, which is an Australian company, I guess founded or at least owned by Rupert Murdoch. And it's a competitor to Ticketmaster. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be here.
Now, what caused News Corp to want to enter the event ticketing market?
Yes, yeah, so it comes from a couple of years ago, really. Part of News Corp's strategy is to diversify their revenues away from being reliant on advertising, you know, as they've done with movies and TV and things like that. And so the Australian market is really being ripe for this for a while because there has been two competitors in the market, Ticketmaster as a global organisation and also Ticketek, who operates very similar to Ticketmaster. There's been no real competition in that market, and ticketing provides a great business to attach to a media organisation because of the ability to promote the events that the ticketing company is selling.
Well, now, how long has Foxtix been in development?
Probably about 3 years, to be honest. News Corp bought a smaller business called Moshtix. So it's very much a grassroots pub and club style ticketing company that also does a lot of music festivals in Australia. So they bought that 3 years ago as a starting point to get into the larger ticketing market.
And I know in America, there's a lot of antipathy towards Ticketmaster, whether deserved or not. People blame them for everything to do with their concert going experience. And I think they would love to see some more competitors for them. What was the reaction from the public when you started to launch Foxtix?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. It's very much the same thing in Australia, where you know the lack of service, the really high fees, and then just a bit inability to try anything different. And one of the crazy things we see down here is that there's still the reluctance to send tickets via email. They're still, you know, you're forced to either pick up the tickets at the venue or have them mailed to you, again, at great expense.
Now, the main reason in America people would have trouble breaking into the ticketing business is because Ticketmaster has signed up deals with all the top venues, everything from Madison Square Garden to you name it, you know, all across the country. They have long-term deals in place. I assume that's the same situation in Australia. How do you gain a foothold on the market when, you know, so many of the big shows will go to those places that already have exclusive deals with Ticketmaster and Ticketek?
Yeah, and that's certainly the case in Australia. And again, this is why when people say, why has it taken so long for a strong competitor to come into the market? It's because of those long-term deals, but more so because of the large upfront money they'll pay to secure those deals, which really acts as a barrier to entry for anyone else without deep pockets. But what our approach is that those deals are typically 3 or 5 years. So you think every year at least a third of those are coming up. So we'll participate in the tenders or the large proposals that you have to put together for those. But there's a lot of things, a lot of events, certainly in Australia, that aren't in those arenas and stadiums, things where they do these, they call tent tours, where they basically put up a tent in a park and put on shows like Cirque du Soleil. There's Peter Pan's and Xanadu tours and things like that that tour around in those areas. As well as a lot of the sporting, like the car racing events, aren't in contracted venues. A lot of them are street circuits. So again, there's no ticketing rights attached to the venues there.
You just mentioned something that was kind of important, and that's how Ticketmaster actually pays venues for the right to sell tickets in their venues. Is that something you think that Foxtix is going to have to do?
With my business hat on, I wish that we didn't have to do that at all, because it's quite uneconomic and there's a lot of risk involved in it. But it's certainly something we're going to have to do to start with. And then we can try and change the market with you know, giving the venues more control that they haven't been provided before. They've just been prepared to accept large upfront payments and then deal with the service or lack of service thereafter.
Well, now let's talk about service for a second. Steve Knopper, or Knopper, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's a writer for Wired magazine, and in this month's issue, he writes a story about all of the young and emerging upstart companies that are trying to take Ticketmaster on, and one of the big problems that they're facing, and this is one of two advantages, the first being the size of Ticketmaster, that they have these long-term contracts and they can pay the venues. The second advantage that Ticketmaster has over these emerging competitors, according to Knopper, is their experience. They have these systems that, while old and maybe not the best, they're strong. They don't go down. And when there's a huge on sale, like for a U2 or a Lady Gaga or a Madonna, the systems don't go down. What system is Foxtix offering, and can you guys guarantee that the venues that it won't collapse during a big on sale?
Well, this is always one of those issues a ticketing company has, is that we put, you know, projections, and we were hurt like this about a year ago with an event we had on sale, and we planned for double the capacity or double the load they had the year before, but it was actually triple the load. And our site had, for about 20 minutes there, wasn't operating too well. But what we can do now is we've got better queuing systems as well. So you just have it like a nice orderly queuing system so you aren't overloading the website. And so you can do that where it's still that effectively like an online queue that you're able to get people in a nice orderly fashion so it doesn't overload the service, but all those people that are in the line effectively get tickets in the right order. All I can say is that which we have built this technology to be able to handle massive loads, whether it's some of these events are well above that load, we'll wait and see.
And do you have any fresh approaches to scalping?
Yes. So this is something we've taken a really strong stance on. And there's a government investigation here in Australia that's underway at the moment to work out whether the government should be involved in legislating. But our approach with that is there's a couple of things that we can do. The first is putting name and date of birth on tickets. So again, using the airline industry as the proxy for it, that you effectively secure the ticket to an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of that is if for some reason the person can't go to the show, because it's secure and locked to them, is we also have a resale functionality so that you can resell your ticket either to a friend or to the public and put it back into public sale.
Now, does Foxtix have any plans to expand outside of Australia?
We do, but the plan at the moment is there's lots of work to do in Australia and New Zealand, and that's our focus probably for the next 18 months. But certainly after that, if these things go well, then it's a model that we'd see rolling out behind a lot of the News Corp media assets around the world, but potentially other markets as well, because it seems there's so many markets around the world that are so poorly served by their ticketing providers at the moment.
Well, certainly, as Michael mentioned, there are two ticketing companies here in the U.S., Ticketmaster, and which is now Live Nation, and AEG. And I know, as Michael mentioned, we're always looking for a fresh competitor to try and enter the marketplace and make it better. We thank you for taking the time to speak with us about Foxtix. And I guess you can visit it at foxtix.com.au.
Yep. Thanks, guys. It's been great.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
It's nice to know that scrappy young competitor News Corp will be taking on big bad Live Nation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, look, I know it's Rupert Murdoch. I know it's News Corp. But still, you know, it's nice to have competition in the marketplace to help drive prices down. Because right now there is no competition in the ticketing market. And I was really surprised that Live Nation was able to buy Ticketmaster. And I know we covered this in a previous episode, but still. And it was nice of Adam to join us and talk about it.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time down under this week, but now it's the end of the show. You'll have to go back to your iPad, Karen. Find a name for it by next week.
Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, when you do go back, you should probably subscribe to our podcast. On the iPad, you'd be doing it in iTunes, or you could do it in the Zune Marketplace, or you can do it via your RSS reader. All of these links can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's podcast, or all of our social networking accounts, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn. As well, there are ways to contact us on the website. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-7263. And those last four numbers stand for SAND, 888-567-SAND. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, and they can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or you can follow him on Twitter, @michaelgiltz is the username to look up. You can follow Karen on Twitter as well, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. And with that iPad, I'm sure there will be far more tweets than there have been in the past.
Can I just tell you, I think people actually listen to this portion of the show because every time after the show goes up, the next day, I get like 3 new followers, which is big for me.
Great. Just 3 new followers?
I got Darren Rouse from Pro Blogger who's following me now. How did that happen?
That's pretty good, actually.
I know.
That's pretty good. Well, you also have a website, KarenWoodwardOnline.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.